DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Christopher Kazor, who is a husband and father, and a professor of philosophy at Loyola Marymount University. He's also the author of The Seven Big Myths About the Catholic Church, The Ethics of Abortion, Women's Rights, Human Life, and the Question of Justice, Thomas Aquinas on the Cardinal Virtues, and Life Issues, Medical Choices. With Dr. Christopher Kazor, we go inside the pages of The Seven Big Myths About Marriage, what science, faith, and philosophy teach us about love and happiness. Published by Ignatius Press. Dr. Kazor, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
It is just a delight to be able to speak to you again about another one of your wonderful books, The Seven Big Myths About Marriage. I mean, you help us to realize that we can reason through so many of the things that challenge us today.
That's right. Yeah, this book, The Seven Big Myths About Marriage, was a result of a course I've taught now for about 15 or 16 years. Because it's a philosophy course, we can't, in philosophy, appeal to authority. As Boethius said, the argument from authority is the weakest kind of argument. So it wouldn't work, in other words, just to say, well, the church teaches this, or John Paul II says this. In philosophy, you have to provide reasons and evidence and arguments. So in this book, what I try to do is think about the church's teachings about a wide variety of issues related to marriage and try to show on a philosophical basis, on a psychological basis, on a sociological basis, that there's actually good reasons for the church holding what the church holds on this. And I try to do it in such a way that it will be understandable and accessible to people from a wide variety of faith traditions.
What I love about it is that it lays down some central premises before you even begin the engagement on marriage. The first being, we must have this understanding about what happiness is. Why did you decide to take that approach?
Because I think that when you're going to talk about specific issues in ethics, it's very, very important to have an overarching framework for thinking about them. And the framework that I'm using is one that originates actually before Christianity with the Greek philosopher Aristotle. And Aristotle held that happiness is activity in accordance with virtue. So in thinking about happiness, what I did in the introduction is think about, well, first of all, the fact that everyone wants to be happy. There's no one around who doesn't care about that. But different kinds of people seek happiness in different kinds of ways. So the hedonist thinks, well, I'll find happiness through, you know, wine, women, and song, or, you know, through bodily pleasure. And as Aristotle pointed out, this route to try to find happiness ends up not working very well for a variety of reasons. And then other people think, well, the way to happiness really is through having more power, more wealth, more fame, more prestige than other people. And if I just get that, then I'll finally be happy. I try to use both philosophy and psychology to show that actually that doesn't work very well either. There's a thing called the arrival fallacy that psychologists talk about. And that's basically the idea that where people say, well, I'll be happy when I get promoted, or when I finally make more than, you know, $50,000, or when, you know, this or that happens to me. But what people find is that once they achieve those levels, basically a new goal arises. It's a little bit like the horizon. You never quite get there. So that's not really going to bring happiness. So what does bring happiness? Well, I provide both philosophical and psychological evidence to bear that basically says that happiness is found in love. Love understood as goodwill for others, appreciating others, and also seeking unity with others. So it's kind of out of that framework of love understood in that way that I think we need to wrestle with all these important issues.
That would be one of the big problems with our conception of marriage today, isn't it? That we enter in because we love someone else, and so we want to get married and share our life. But because for whatever reason, happiness is broken, or maybe we entered in thinking we were happy and now we're not happy. I mean, it gets so muddled up because we really just don't understand even the basic vocabulary, the definition of terms.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And that's why the first big myth I talk about is the idea that love is simple. And everyone has some experience of love. You know, hopefully everyone had a mother or father that loved them, or friends that loved them, hopefully husband and wife that loved them. So we all have some experience of love, but love actually is kind of complex, and it's important to try to sift through different understandings of love. And so one of the things that I think is really important is to think about love not just as a matter of emotion. It is true that when we love someone, typically emotions arise, but we can also think about love as a decision or an act, a choice. And I think, as particularly in marriage, it's important to remember that that is an aspect of love. So good feelings are important, and hopefully we have those a lot of the time, but good feelings can be undermined by all kinds of things. I mean, in my case, if I don't get enough sleep at night, gosh, the next day I'm cranky and my good feelings are kind of not there. So we can't run our life, you know, simply on the matter of emotions, and really much more important are our decisions and choices. And actually, when we choose to be kind to others and appreciate them and seek union with them, typically those good emotions actually will follow. Maybe not immediately, but as we continue to kind of invest, as it were, in the other person, those good emotions typically follow. So I do think it's important to think carefully about, you know, what love is, and that's what I try to do in the first chapter of the book.
Well, once we do that, I mean, you find someone, you feel that you can love them authentically and appropriately. I mean, we go into marriage, but as you brought out in that second myth, it can't be conceived as a contract, something that can be broken. I mean, I think that's how we end up taking these relationships into a courtroom.
Yeah, no, that's right. So the second big myth is that marriage is a 50-50 contract. And many people do think of it that way. They think of marriage almost like a business deal where, you know, you do this for me and I'll do this for you. But what I propose is, as another option of thinking about marriage, is that marriage really is 100% covenant. Now, what's the difference between a contract and a covenant? Well, in a contract, the parties exchange goods and services. So, you know, you agree to paint my house and I agree to pay you to paint the house. Or you agree to change the oil and I agree to pay you for that. But in a covenant, what you're giving isn't goods and services. What you're giving is really yourself. So in marriage, what the husband is giving to his wife is himself, now and until death do us part. And likewise, the wife is giving herself to the husband. And what's created in a covenant is a family bond. And family bonds are all about unconditional love. Every parent knows that. So when you have a child, you don't, you know, love that child just if the child is kind of pleasing to you or making you happy. You love that child no matter what. And hopefully things go well. But if things don't go well, you're still that child's parent. And in a covenant marriage, what's created is similar. It's a family bond. It's about unconditional love. And so when I got married, I promised to love my wife in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. And so in making that vow and that promise, what I created is this covenant relationship. So my wife and I are husband and wife, again, until death. And there's nothing that kind of dissolves that. Just as, say, I'm the father of my children until death. The only thing that undoes me being a father would be the death of one of my children, God forbid. So when we think about marriage in this way, when we think about it as a creating a family bond and think about it really in terms of unconditional love, then we have a choice. You know, do we want unconditional love or not? Most people, I think, when they get married, really do want unconditional love. And part of that, therefore, is indissolubility.
I'm curious to know that if in your classroom you begin to teach this, you're dealing with a generation where, at the very least, half of those, by statistics, would say that half of those students come from homes where that was never demonstrated as far as a lifetime commitment in a covenantal type of relationship. They come from broken homes.
Right.
What's the response that you get from the students as you begin to enter into this?
Well, I think it's very interesting because I have some students who will say, that's impossible. You can't have that kind of relationship with someone. That just doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And what I say to them is, you know, I think it does exist. I think in your own life, even though maybe your parents split up, you, I hope, have had an experience of unconditional love. And I say to them, don't you think it's true that even if you became a murderer and you were just, you know, an arsonist or just something terrible, isn't it true that your mother would still love you? And, you know, they kind of say, you know, that's true. And we do see this. We literally, when people are accused of horrible crimes, very often in the courtroom, the only people other than the attorney who will be on the, you know, the accused side is, you know, the mother and father, and they still love them. Of course, they're terribly disappointed in the behavior, but they still love them. So I think even when people have this experience in their own life of a marriage breaking down in their parents' case, I think almost everyone can see, you know what, I have been loved in this unconditional way. And even though one of the difficulties of having a family that's broken is that it leads you to think of marriage in this sort of transitory way. And I know my wife, her family is, her mother's been married 3 times, and she, when we were married for the first probably 10 years, whenever we'd have a big fight, she'd say, "That's it, we're getting divorced, it's over." You know, because in her mind, that's kind of what she saw. Obviously, this is not a high point in our marriage, but you know, just because we have a downtime doesn't mean that it's over and that things are not going to get better. And actually, the research bears that out. The majority of unhappy couples, if they stick with their marriage, 5 years later, about 4/5 of them report that they're happy again. So marriages are a little bit like health, where some people are blessed with good health their whole life and they don't have serious health problems, but almost everyone has, at one time or another, you know, a health challenge. And just because you have a health challenge does not mean you're going to die or it's the end of your life. But, you know, it's tough. But most of the time when we have health problems, we recover, right? We come back. And the same thing's true in terms of marriage.
It really brings us to that third myth where love alone makes a marriage. And sometimes, as you pointed out, my husband and I have been married for over 30 years now. And I don't think you'd mind me sharing with folks that there are times when, yes, I believe I loved him, but there are sometimes I didn't like him very much. But but you keep going. Somehow you're able to make it to the other side.
Yeah. No, I think the reality is that, and again, I talk about this in the book, that all couples have irreconcilable differences. All couples do. The couples that stay married and are happy, the couples that are miserable, and the couples that get divorced. So the difference between, you know, couples that end up making it and being overall happy and those that get divorced or those that are miserable isn't having these differences. But one of the key differences is how they deal with their disagreements and their irreconcilable differences. And those don't need to destroy things. And I think, again, with all marriages virtually have ups and downs. You know, again, think of your health. You know, it's not always going to be perfect. You're going to get sinus infections. You might even get cancer, God forbid. But, you know, those things don't need to be, you know, the end of your life. So yeah, part of what I try to do with the students is to help them be realistic in the sense of marriage is wonderful and marriage brings huge blessings both to the people who are married and to the kids and to the whole community. It's a great thing. But also marriage is a challenge, right? There's a reason that we take vows and we say things like, you know, in good times and in bad, right? In sickness and in health, richer, poor. In other words, most people's lives, if you're single too, this is true, most people's lives are not an endless, beautiful sunrises and birds chirping and everything is wonderful. Look, if you're married, you're going to have ups and downs in your life. If you're single, you'll have ups and downs in your life. Human life is challenging. That's no one gets through this life without some serious challenges, regardless of marital status. But when you're married, like when you're a parent, you've made this commitment to love. And this is the real path to happiness. Again, whether you're single or whether you're married, the path to true happiness is love. And love is going to involve challenges, right? Whether it's a parental relationship, a marriage relationship, if you're a priest or a nun, there's challenges in that. You know, you might have a bishop that doesn't like you or you don't like him or whatever. So, you know, that's just the nature of human life. But the part of the beauty of it is as Christian people, at least, we can see that no challenge is a definitive knockout. That is to say, even if we have a really difficult, horrible situation, the worst situation imaginable, we know that this is not going to last forever, and this does not ruin everything, and that we have the promise and hope of eternal happiness, which can really help us weather some difficult storms.
Okay. Now, if we can make it through those first three big myths, and in most general conversation, you might be able to get folks to agree on this, as you proceed in the other areas, this is where it gets very emotional because people are really living this out. And the fourth big myth is cohabitation is just like marriage.
Yeah, cohabitation. And many, many of my students think this. And what I try to do is provide lots and lots of evidence that this isn't true. So I cite, I don't even know how many different studies that basically show that there are major differences between couples that cohabitate on the one hand and couples that are married on the other. So if you look at, for instance, the length of a relationship, couples that cohabitate have, on average, a shorter length of relationship. If you look at fidelity in a relationship, yes, there are married folks that cheat, but it's much, much more likely to happen within cohabitation. If you look at violence within a relationship, much more likely to happen in a cohabiting relationship. If you look at drug and alcohol abuse, much more likely. So in other words, some people think that really counts as love, having a good relationship, having a lasting relationship, having fidelity. If that's what you care about, it's much, much more likely to happen within a marriage than it is within cohabitation. The other side of the coin is that many of my students believe that cohabitation is a great way to prepare for a lasting marriage. In other words, this is a way to make sure you don't get divorced. You know, you live together, and if you do this, then you really know whether you're making a good decision, and this will lower your likelihood of divorcing. Again, with the research that I have in the book shows that just the opposite is the case. In fact, cohabitation increases the likelihood of divorce, and the longer a couple cohabits, the more likely it is that they'll get divorced. So many students have misunderstandings about this issue, and particularly the female students, because they think, oh, this is great. This is kind of a step towards marriage and a step towards engagement. But what I argue in the book is that cohabitation actually is especially detrimental to women. So here's my reasoning. Worldwide, when men are asked about what they look for in a marriage partner, worldwide, men prize and value youth and beauty, their marriage partner. And this is kind of no surprise to people, I imagine. And worldwide, what they found also is that women, when they're thinking about a marriage partner, more than men, they value the stability, the economic well-being, the ability to provide in a man. So what happens when a couple cohabits? Well, let's say they move in together at 25. And then they live together for 7 years. So now we're there at 32. Now, the majority, 4 out of 5 cohabiting couples don't get married. So they're at 32 and unmarried. So what's happened over the course of time? Well, what's happened is that the man has typically gained more of what most women are looking for in a marriage partner. Most men are further along in their career at 32 than they were at 25. They're making more money. They're more established. They're more prominent, et cetera. And what's happened to the woman? Well, she's lost more of what most men are looking for in a marriage partner. And so relative to where they began, the man has made himself better off in the marriage market, and the woman has put herself at a disadvantage in the marriage market. So I think some women think of this as kind of helpful or advantageous for them, but I think the reality is it really puts them at a disadvantage in relationship to the man who cohabits.
Partnered with that in a very real way, in a very painful way, ultimately, is the effects of premarital sex, whether you're cohabitating or not.
That's right. Yeah, so that's the fifth big myth, is that premarital sex is no big deal. And there I basically provide an argument, two arguments, that sex outside of marriage is contrary to the kind of happiness that we talked about in the beginning of the show today, the happiness that consists in really loving others and helping them. So part of what loving others involves is obviously not harming people, but also not risking their well-being. So if you think about, say, drunk driving is not wrong because every single time someone drives drunk, they always injure themselves or always kill someone on the road. No, it's wrong because every time someone drives drunk, they're risking or endangering the well-being of others. Sometimes they get home and no one gets hurt and they're lucky, but nevertheless, they still risk or endanger the well-being of others by driving drunk. So in a similar way, sex outside of marriage risks or endangers the well-being, not just of the people that are engaged in it, but also the many human beings that are conceived through sex outside of marriage. And when a pregnancy takes place outside of marriage, there are very limited options that the couple can do, all of which to a greater or lesser degree endanger the well-being of the child who's conceived. So obviously abortion not just endangers the well-being, but ends the well-being of the child. Raising the child alone as a single parent, there's lots of research that shows that this is likely to put the child at a significant disadvantage. A cohabitation, as we saw, has significant disadvantages. And then the two best options would be adoption and getting married. But both of those also are not ideal. And what happens in reality is that many people lack the courage either to place their child for adoption or to get married in those circumstances. So actually the most common response is abortion. And if love consists in helping others, and especially those that are in need, you can see kind of quite clearly that abortion would be something that would be incompatible with that kind of happiness.
It just seems to contribute to that lack of appreciation, can we say, of what love and what true happiness is. Because the child raised in that environment, that's what's modeled for them. So it goes back to the point of those who may be sitting in your classroom looking at you saying that it's not possible because they've just never experienced it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think it is true that this is the sort of thing that a lot of people do. And so sometimes people say, well, look, everyone's doing this, so it can't be bad. But I think that's not really very clear thinking. There are all kinds of things that people do. I mean, I ask the students, you know, how many people here have been mean to their mother? You know, everyone raises their hand. How many people here have ever stolen anything, you know, as a child or recently or whatever, anything? Everyone raises their hand. Well, clearly, right? Mm-hmm. Stealing is not okay, even though virtually everyone does it. Clearly being mean to your mother is not okay, again, even though everyone does it. So, and that's part of the myth too, is that everyone does it. Not everyone has premarital sex. There's many, about a quarter of college students have never had sex at all, right? I mean, people don't know this. They think, oh, everyone's doing it. No, that's not true. And so that's part of what I try to let them know, is that not everyone does this. In fact, the majority of college students are not in a sexual relationship. The majority are. So, you know, for those people who are not in a sexual relationship, young people, that is, again, like the majority. So people, if you watch television, you get a very distorted kind of view, or movies, you kind of think one thing's the case. The reality is quite different. That's actually kind of part of what I try to teach them, is that they shouldn't get caught up in the kind of media distortions that kind of portray things in a really false way.
Well, in the creation of these families in which the children are born into, this creation that a family which occurs in marriage, through a marriage, is one of its primary purposes is to help those children be able to practice out and to learn these virtues and to learn how to interact in society as they grow into adulthood so they can go out and be very productive. And one of the big myths, the number six, was that children are irrelevant in marriage. And yet,
yeah,
it's so important.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. One of the things, yeah, people think of children as kind of irrelevant for marriage, and I think the reality is that children contribute greatly to the flourishing of their parents. And so one of the things that I emphasize is how children help realize the goal of erotic love. So erotic love is a kind of love that seeks unity with the other person, that wants to be as much together with them as possible. And when a couple has children, that kind of unity is really created, right? This child bonds this man and this woman together in the most permanent sort of way, right? As long as that child is alive, there's a kind of living monument to the unity that exists between the mother and the father. And children also help strengthen the marital relationship because it provides a source for activity for the parents, namely raising that child. And it unifies them also in terms of a shared emotional life. So when things go well for the child, that parents rejoice together. When the child is hurt and in the hospital, the parents are very concerned together. So children really kind of bring the couple together. And in the book, I also argue that children help the parents get to heaven. One of the things that our Lord said is that when at the final judgment, he would separate those that go to heaven from those that go to hell by means of saying, you know, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was naked and you clothed me. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Come into the kingdom. And I remember hearing that passage as a child and thinking, oh my gosh, this is terrible because, you know, everyone's going to go to hell except for Mother Teresa and her sisters because, you know, who does this? But if you think about it, you know, all good fathers and all good mothers literally do those things, right? When the child's hungry, they feed that child. When their child is thirsty, they give him or her something to drink. When the child's naked, they clothe that child, especially as a baby. Literally, they put on clothes. And I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. Well, parents do that too, right? Every child comes into a family as a stranger, right? You don't know whether that child is going to be outgoing or reserved, whether the child will be a great athlete or very clumsy, whether the child will be brilliant or have learning disabilities. So regardless of what the child is, we welcome that child. It's a stranger now, but we're going to learn about that child and love that child, whoever they are. So children, I think, greatly strengthen the marital relationship. And the evidence, the stats bear that out, where if you look at the rate of divorce for couples that have no children worldwide, it's about 34%. For couples that have one child, it goes down to 24. If they've got two children, it goes down to 16. If they've got four or more children, the rate of divorce goes all the way down to 4%. So having children together is a kind of glue, a kind of bond that really does unite the marital couple together.
That seventh big myth, it talks about the all reproductive choices are equal. And that is a major elephant in the middle of the room that couples need to discuss. I mean, what is the purpose of those reproductive choices that are presented to us?
Yeah, the seventh myth really builds, as it were, on the sixth myth. In other words, in the chapter six, I'm trying to argue that having children is good. There's something really good about having children. And that is really the reason that the church teaches what it does about contraception. If we wanted to learn, you know, why does the church teach lying is wrong? Well, you'd have to understand something about why the truth is a good thing. And if you want to say, well, why does the church teach that stealing is wrong? Well, that presupposes that private property is a good thing. And so it's important to understand the church's teaching on contraception in light of the church's teaching about how good children are. And so in the seventh chapter, I kind of explore that idea of the goodness of children as that is giving rise to the problematic nature of contraception. The other kind of reproductive aspect is not having unity without procreation, but having procreation without unity. And that is, for instance, in vitro fertilization. So I talk about the reality that children conceived in this way are more likely to have serious disabilities, and the fact that the ways in vitro fertilization is used in the United States ends up harming many, many human embryos that are either frozen indefinitely or even killed in the process of using IVF. So this is, again, a kind of issue where I don't think a lot of Catholics have been very well educated, or people, not just Catholics, but people have been very well educated about the ethical issues surrounding in vitro fertilization.
I wish, Christopher, that we had more time to be able to go in, but that's the beauty of being able to have the seven big myths about marriage, what science, faith, and philosophy teach us about love and happiness. And so I hope people go out so that they can go even deeper into the questions that we've risen today. And we look forward to the next. Thank you so
Great.
Much.
Oh, my pleasure. Great talking with you.
With Dr. Christopher Cazor, we've gone inside the pages of The Seven Big Myths About Marriage, what science, faith, and philosophy teach us about love and happiness. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.